sure to answer.
Here's a question for Lucia. Do you have any pets? Are you even an animal person? Do you like Star Wars? Do you even know what Star Wars is? That's a great question, because I'm afraid of what some of you might ask. So I hope they're all like that. It does make you curious, though. Okay. Let's see. Do we have any additional cool kids? Oh, right here. Thank you so much. Man, that looks awesome.
Do I look old?
I see that hand. God bless you, sister. That's awesome. Oh, wow. There's the grand prize right there. We got hat, we got shirt, we got mug. I like that. Gaslighting. He said, you get a book. Oh, you got coffee, too.
Yeah, your weight told me to go like this the whole time.
You did what?
Squeeze it so you guys can all swallow.
Oh, squeeze it.
It's like Charmin.
Charmin? Is that what she's telling people out there? I guess she's going by age, because you would know what that means.
She didn't say that.
Oh, you said that. Well, I knew what you meant. Kids, have you ever squeezed the Charmin? You know what that is? Mr. Whiffle?
Whiffle.
You know him, huh?
It's not Whiffle. Whiffle.
Is it Whiffle?
That's what they say in the North.
Okay, so that reminds me that I mentioned Randall a while ago, but the Dietzel family has been supporting us for years as well, and I appreciate that. As I was saying with Randall Rhodes over here, I don't want y'all just to go straight up FOMO. I want to give you the opportunity to support our ministry as well. And for those of you who have more money than a show dog can jump over, and you're looking for a 501c3 organization to support, and it doesn't take away from your support of your local church, we would be obliged if you would support our little ministry. We're going to continue, by the grace of God, to give our resources away. And we reach tens of thousands of people every day and week around the world. It's a phenomenal thing. God is just doing a great work. We're missionaries. We're cyber missionaries. We live in cyberspace. And in 2008, On July the 3rd, specifically, 2008, I wrote my first blog post. Did not know, I knew why, but I didn't know where it was going. On July the 4th, I wrote another blog post. And then July the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. And for two straight years, I wrote a blog post every day for 2 years. And then in 2010, someone from Texas wrote, said, "You have a training program. The answer in business is yes, and we'll figure it out later." So I said yes. It wasn't a lie. I had one in my mind. And then I told Lucia, "I'm going to be busy this weekend creating a all-online school," which has been running for 14 years now. And so we trained people in biblical counseling. In 2015, a gentleman emailed from Atlanta. He says, "I'm reading impaired. Have you ever thought about podcasting in business?" The answer is always yes, and then you figure it out later. And so we started podcasting. I've got a couple thousand podcasts. Then when the pandemic came, we decided to start doing videos more intentionally. We've been doing them before. And so then we started producing our content in a read, watch, listen format, because some people like to read, some like to watch, some like to listen. I backed off on writing an article a day and produce three a week, three podcasts, three videos, three articles. And then we started writing books. There's three out there. I have two more in my head that I want to write. Our days are typically about 16 hours a day. And so I got more to do than I can do. We're trying to get it done. And I mentioned earlier, I write a book a month, a smaller 20,000 plus word book, and to give away. And it's great when those receipts come in. One lady from, I don't know where she's from, but New Hampshire, like the other day, downloaded 15 books. Ah, that's so awesome. And you see those receipts come in from all over the world. I mean, receipts as in acknowledgement. I mean, they're free. There's not a cost. But for tracking purpose, we can track how many we're giving away. And we give away thousands of books. People write in from all over the world. We're on YouTube and LinkedIn and Facebook. We get 1,600 new followers a week on Facebook. And it's just a remarkable thing to be able to reach so many people with the gospel, the practical message of Christ. My forte is the application of theology. What Rick does and the elders do here, mostly primarily, and what they should be doing is teaching theology primarily, which they do and do well. And I'm the application, so he's primarily orthodoxy, I'm primarily orthopraxy. And that's a good combination. But that's been my heart, because when I went through, people will ask sometimes, you know, why do you do what you do? Well, these things that I'm sharing is why I do what I do, because when I came to that place in my life where my life had fallen apart, I don't mean this critically at all, just more factually, because I don't have any bitterness whatsoever about this. But my church could not help me. They had no idea how to help me. In fact, my assistant pastor told me, because I asked him, and he said, "We don't know what to do with you." He said, "You did not break your arm," which was a humble admission. If you had broken your arm, we know what to do with someone who breaks their arm, but we don't know what to do with a person like you. And that set me on a course to figure out what to do with a person like me. And that course led through a change of theology, which began, as I mentioned earlier, when I realized that God was decreed these things. Ended up going to MacArthur School in Santa Clarita, California, and got a master's in biblical counseling. Then became certified with ACBC. It's a counseling organization. Then became a fellow with them in 2006. And started this ministry. I pastored for a while. I didn't like pastoring. Pastoring's too hard. I'm a one-trick pony. I'm an orthopraxy guy. I'm an application guy. Pastors wear 47 hats, and they never get to wear one long enough and well enough before they're putting another one on. And pastoring is, it's not an impossible job, but it's a profoundly hard job, and I didn't care for it. And if I do anything reasonably well, it's one thing, and that's the application of the Bible. And so I said, to heck with pastoring. And actually, I need to stop Christian cursing. I need to come up with that. I said, I desirous no longer to be in pastoral ministry. That sounds better. I'll start using that. So that's why I wrote that blog post, and then, man, no idea. And doggone. It just, oh, I did it again. Old potty mouth up here. Why are you laughing? Anyway, y'all pray for her. Anyway, and the Lord chose to bless it, and I call it comical. It's a comical in the sense of, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. You've had those comical moments with God as well. It's like, wow, you got to be kidding me. It's like, Lord, seriously. When my Facebook friend, my schoolmates from elementary school find me on Facebook, that's what I mean by comical. They write and it's like, Ricky, because that's my name. That's what's on my birth certificate. Ricky. Nobody calls me Rick. They call me Ricky. They say, Ricky, my mouth, my jaw rather, is still on the floor. I cannot believe. You twisted, introverted person. We know who you are. And when 50 years goes by and they see you again, their jaws on the floor. That's what I mean by comical. It's like, you have got to be kidding me. So anyway, but I know the story. And you know, I told y'all one time, I used to run around with Randy Travis, the country music star. And did I put the picture up here on the wall? Yeah, so Drew contacted Randy Travis and his wife and told him some of the things I told y'all about some of the things we did when I was a teenager, and Randy and his wife made a video, and Drew he gave it to me on my birthday. I hadn't seen Randy in 50 years. I've I've always, it's been one of those things, I'm going to go see him someday, you know. It's kind of like when you're in New York and you talk to New Yorkers and you say, hey, you've been to Statue of Liberty? They, oh, no, it's just wild, I won't go someday. They never go. And I've always planned to reconnect and just never have. And I got a 4-minute video on my iPhone of Randy and his wife, mostly his wife because Randy had a stroke. But anyway, just a weed smoking redneck from North Carolina doing bad things. And God regenerated me and put me on a different path. And yeah, it's a remarkable thing. But I wanted to honor Drew, as I told him. There's two kind of gifts you give Christians. One's a necktie. And that's the one where the dude forgot. So he's down at Walmart, you know, December 24th, looking in the necktie department because he loves my brother. And then there's other gifts where somebody thinks about it and, like, goes the extra mile. Those are gospel gifts. I'm not sure what a necktie is, but it ain't no gospel gift. But those are gospel gifts where somebody puts thought in it and then, you know, does the work. And I just want to honor him. He showed it to me the other night because he sent it to me, and somehow I got messed up. I was in France with our son in Normandy and got messed up in Wi-Fi or something. So I didn't see it till like 2 nights ago. And I do what I do. I cry. But we made a memory, didn't we? John and Callie were there. That was good. Anyway, I think I was asking for money. We do not want to lose track. So let me bring this thing back around. Would you stop it? I'm trying to be serious.
You got me laughing and crying.
So for those of you who love the Lord and are able to support our ministry, I would really love it if you do. We work sincerely hard. God has given me a good work ethic, and so I will never sin the sin of laziness. I will sin by working too hard too long. I will do that, but it will never be the sin of laziness. And so if you're able to support us, you can go to our coffee shop. If you become you can donate, or you can become a supporting member. If you become a supporting member, we have private forums on the backside. We have an entire training regimen on the backside, where we're interacting with our community on a daily basis. And so we do a lot of training on the backside in a very private forum that's off the grid, where we talk about some very personal things that people are struggling through. So we are an equipping ministry, but on the front end, our coffee shop is free. You can walk in it. You can get anything you want. You can take it home and share it with 1,000 of your closest friends. If you're able to support, it would really help, because it's an expensive, it has become an expensive ministry because of all the things that we do. Our website looks like IKEA. If you've ever been to IKEA, just think about the bowels of Hades. It's where you, or Hotel California, for those of you over 40, you just get in, you can't get out, you don't know, it's like where you are, and it's overwhelming because there's so much content on it. But if you would go two or three times or four, then you would, IKEA is not that bad at the 15th time. And you can get used to it. But we have worked very hard in making our website user-friendly because I understand there's so much content on it that it takes a lot of work to make that thing intuitive. And we still have work to do, but it's also costly. All right, so I want to talk about God being silent. We'll go till 3 o'clock, if I understand the time correctly. Is that correct, Rick? Got it. Silence. The silence of God. Silence does not have to be a bad thing, including the silence of God. James talked about being quick to listen and slow to speak. That is a biblical idea of not talking, being silent. I'm not talking about the silent treatment. That's another talk. But I'm talking about the silence of God. The gifts of reflection and pondering seem lost in our impulsive, ready, fire, aim culture. There are times when silence is actually wisdom. Have you considered the deliberateness of God? I have. Deliberateness is a fancy way of saying it, I suppose. But God just ain't talking. We talk about a brass ceiling. During the Lord's quietness, actually, he can communicate some of the most profound truths if you're willing to listen to his silence. But whether speaking or not, we must trust the Lord's wisdom because life does not function formulaically. God is a speaking God. We would not know anything about God if he were not a speaking God. And what he has spoken is in his word, and everything that we know about God is only in his word, and of course those things that have been extrapolated out of his word. But God is quiet as well. In Proverbs 16:9, it says, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." And I'm sure that you're aware that God establishes our steps, which does not necessarily mean that he also communicates the backstory or the motive for directing us this way or that way. The best we can do is to make our plans while holding them loosely, knowing that God's will operates on a higher plane than ours. Even after we set our course with his blessing, he can insert a course corrective. I'm sharing these things because, again, my journey through Job is autobiographical, and he sent me to South Carolina to go to Bible college, and it was very clear where I was going and where I was going to end up. And all of you have had those plans as well, whatever they may be. Marriage is the most obvious one. You get married, this is what you do, this is the course, and you pretty much presume how it's going to end up. Sometimes he will insert that course corrective. What was true one time is not true all the time. Our plans made sense to us when we laid them before the Lord, but he redirected our paths differently, and sometimes his paths led us to places that we have never anticipated. Human ingenuity and understanding cannot answer all of our questions because we serve an active God who is always working in ways that we cannot fully understand, comprehend, or explain. This challenge is tough. And as I was saying about Job earlier, it is scary. When our plans fall apart and we face plant into personal suffering. Typically when this happens, we are tempted to focus on what we did wrong, or maybe we direct our disappointment toward the Lord because he did not meet our expectations, and so again we begin to lower him down so that we can argue with him because we believe that he has failed us. Perhaps you did not do anything wrong. Or maybe you didn't do anything crazy enough to warrant such suffering. To falsify the character of the sufferer, you did wrong. Or to falsify the character of the Lord, he did wrong. That should not be our first consideration. Now, I know Job's friends were falsifying his character, as in, you must have done something wrong because of these troubles. And we want to be careful about that, that we don't falsify the character of God or falsify the character of the sufferer, because that does not help. And in many cases, it's not even true. Perhaps the Lord knows better than we do, and so he redirects our paths in such a way that brings pain into our lives. We see that story in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. The story of Paul receiving a thorn in the flesh. Similar to Job, God sent a messenger of Satan to harass him because of the arrogance that Paul had through the revelations that he had received and the propensity for being proud because of the abundant revelations that he had received. God sent a messenger from Satan to harass him, a thorn in the flesh, and Paul prayed as we would pray, if it's possible, Lord, if you would take this away from us, from me. And so Paul's path was going very clear. He was doing well. And then all of a sudden it is redirected as he receives this thorn in the flesh. He prays. He asks God to take it away. God says, no, my grace is sufficient for you. And that was an unchangeable situation in his life. It is possible for the Lord to be up to something that can only come through our suffering. Could the deep pain we are going through today be the tapestry the Lord will use to show the beauty of his plans for us? These are helpful truths to consider as we reflect on his mysterious and good intentions for us. If you're unsure of his purposes, the real issue for you to ponder during these times of suffering is the silence of God. Why does the Lord not tell you the plans that he has for you? Why does he have to be silent? When God begins to speak in Job's life, in Job 28, Job says, but where shall wisdom be found? You can hear the urgency in Job's mind. He is lost, he's confused, he's hurting, he's been accused, he has accused. And he is looking for wisdom. He wants to know the answers. The silence of God. God is not speaking. God does not begin to communicate until chapter 38. And so Job is asking here, but where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? In Job 28:12. In verses 20 and 21, from where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. God is silent. Job can't find wisdom. He can't find the answers. It's important to understand in the moments of the silence of God that silence does not mean a lack of leadership. Silence doesn't mean that God is not leading. Just because God is not speaking to you, it would be wrong to assume that he is not leading you. Leadership is verbal. Slight caveat right here. I say hyperbolically, maybe. Leadership is 95% verbal. I tell husbands this all the time. Leadership is verbal. Again, we would not know anything about God if he were not verbal. God is a speaking God. If he did not give us his word, we would not know anything about him. God is a speaking God, and made in the image of God, we want to be verbal. As men, we want to be speaking men, communicating. Being verbal is the primary way that we will lead others, by talking, leading, directing, giving instruction. However, leadership is also silence. It can be that there are times when the Lord needs to choose silence over speaking. We see this in Job 28, where our old friend needed the wisdom to figure out what was going on in his life. He went through 25 chapters of back and forth with his friends leading to nowhere. The Lord was mysteriously silent through all of this jabbering, and Job was aware of God's quietness. He was hungry for God's words, and he was weary of men's wisdom. Job knew he needed a speaking God, but he could not find him in his mess, as I shared earlier in 23:3. Oh, where shall I find him? I would come even to his seat. I would fill my mouth with arguments. Job was desperate to hear from a non-speaking God. You are hurting and struggling, and the Lord keeps his cards close to his divine vest. And so Job cries in 28, where is wisdom? Now, what is wisdom? Wisdom is living in a skill that is active, moving, and doing. That is wisdom. Wisdom is living in a skill that is active, moving, and doing. Wisdom is not passive. Wisdom is not static. Wisdom is fluid. Wisdom does not sit still. Wisdom gives you what you need to respond actively to God and others. It's an ever-increasing and maturing knowledge that you actively apply in the milieu, in the environment in which you, the social environment in which you live. Wisdom is not a philosophical idea or a preachy cliche. Wisdom is a theologically precise, active practice of God's work through you and into your life context. Wisdom is what you need a lot of to do life well. And Job did not have it. Where is wisdom? His life fell apart, and he needed the active wisdom of the Lord to put his life back together again. And this is where it gets interesting on our journey with Job. The Lord does not answer his query for wisdom. For the first time since the beginning of the book, the Lord speaks in 28:28, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. So the Lord, Job is asking, where is wisdom? And in 28:28, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. So, you're looking for wisdom? I have found it. The location of wisdom is in the fear of God. That is the location of wisdom. Now, I would be curious, without raising any hands, did you expect that? Did you know that? That wisdom is situated in the fear of God. There is an inseparable connection between the wisdom of the Lord and the fear of the Lord, and I will explain. You gain wisdom by actively walking on the path of life with the Lord, and the fear of the Lord is how you walk on that path. The two are inseparable. I'll say it again. You gain wisdom by actively walking on the path of life with the Lord. And the fear of the Lord is how you walk on that path. Without the fear of the Lord, you will not be wise, because you need the fear of God to make wisdom what wisdom is. There is a perfect symmetry that most Christians have not considered. At best, they see wisdom as a knowledge-gathering exercise, motivating them to study God's word, an absolute essential. But that wisdom lacks a vital ingredient, the fear of God. Wisdom without the fear of God is not biblical wisdom. What is the fear of God? The fear of the Lord means to take Him seriously. The fear of the Lord means to take Him seriously, knowing that He alone is wise and powerful. And so you can't walk in wisdom if we are not taking the Lord seriously. Therefore, the fear of the Lord undergirds the walking in wisdom. The two are inseparable. The fear of the Lord is a contrite recognition that we are not wise and that we are not strong. Because of who He is, we can trust Him fully and always and to any degree. God is God, and we are not. The fear of the Lord, as I said earlier, is not to be afraid of Him. The fear of the Lord is to be afraid of ourselves. It is a simultaneous recognition of who we are and who He is, while discerning the ginormous difference between those two opposites. This kind of solemn respect for the Lord brings humility to our souls. The fear of the Lord forms the base upon which we gather and store wisdom. We have clever people in our world, but they have no fear of God. The wise person has a healthy fear of God. They recognize that He is God, I am not. And it brings a humility to their souls. And then upon that, they collect and gather wisdom. And then they actively live out that wisdom, all the while undergirded by the fear of God. The fear of God and the wisdom of God work together as cause and effect. The foundational fear of the Lord is the cause that produces the wisdom of the Lord, the effect. Without a right understanding of and a maturing fear of the Lord, a person will not be able to gain wisdom from the Lord. If we do not respect God, we can't expect God to give us wisdom, which is a clue, hence, to the silence of God. It would be like pouring water on oil. The result for a person who does not fear God the right way will experience ongoing, unremitting frustration in his life and relationships, which brings us to Job. Job was not taking God seriously. He did not have a healthy fear of God as he should have. He was popping off at the mouth, lacing his words with accusations. His lack of a proper fear of God kept the wisdom of the Lord veiled to him. Have you ever heard someone speak in such a way that you knew that they were angry with God? They might not have said the quiet part aloud because of Christian etiquette and propriety. But as they talk about their life, as they talk about their relationships, as they talk about their situations, you can hear accusations toward God, even though they could do so unwittingly, not self-aware of what they're actually doing, the God who is sovereign over all things. If we complain or grumble on the earthly plane, it is not as though those things are happening to us outside of God's control and permission. He is omnipresent and omnipotent. He is omniscient. He is fully aware of every hair on our heads and even our plans. He has the sovereign right to establish our paths. My point is that God is in charge and we are not. Thus, when things do not meet our expectations, our responses and reactions to those on the human plane will reveal our fear of God or the lack thereof. And if we are responding as foolishly as Job responded, then we do not have an active fear of God. Therefore, the wisdom of God will be veiled, hidden, and not provided. Therefore, if we want the wisdom of God in our lives, and we're not receiving the wisdom of God in our lives, and we're experiencing the silence of God, then we have to address, do we have a healthy understanding and practice of the fear of God? When life does not make sense, God sees this. He knows that we do not understand because we are not omniscient. Parents understand this concept very well. They know that there is wisdom and understanding that the child cannot possibly possess. The child must trust beyond their knowledge. The child must trust beyond their awareness of how things ought to be. If the child does not have a sober assessment of what they lack and what their parents possess, they will miss the wisdom of the parents. And their lives will become more complicated than they need to be. There are many things that a parent would like to tell their children, but only when the child is genuinely broken and humbly asking can the parent speak with authority and clarity. Because the parent knows. The child is not listening because the child is angry, the child is rebellious, the child does not respect. The child has no reverential respect for the parents. And if the child does not have proper reverence for the parents may choose silence because it is obvious the child is unwilling to listen. The child's lack of reverence for the parent shuts him out from his parents' wisdom. Some would argue, I have been seeking the Lord. I've been asking for his wisdom. I want to know his thoughts and his plans for me. And no doubt, all of these things are true. But this is where it will become hard for the inquirer. If the Lord is silent with us, he is rooting something out of us. Many times in my life, I've uploaded seeking the Lord and pleading for wisdom with self-preserving motives and agendas. I was not mature enough or genuinely transparent enough to hear what I needed to hear, and thus the Lord was silent. There was no use for God to speak because I laced my motives with self. The Lord's silence in my situation was not because he was mean. He is wise and loving. He knew how the thoughts and intentions of my heart were not pure. The silence of the Lord lasted as long as I persisted in holding on to what I wanted more than what he knew was best for me. And so in my heart of hearts, I knew I was not willing to relinquish my plans entirely. And he knew that too. The search for wisdom and its application through the process of elimination. The more you eliminate what you want while thrusting yourself on the Lord, regardless of the cost, the more wisdom you will possess. And thus, as we read in Proverbs 3, 5, 6, and 7, as you're familiar with, trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. You see how there is no impure motives. There can't be any pure motives here. And I'm kind of masterful in prayer trickery. As I pray to God in all sincerity while holding on to these subtle motives and desires of my heart. I call it manipulative praying. Lord, I am better when I know that that's not exactly true. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. When suffering happens, a typical first response is to manage and control the situation in a way that makes sense to the hurting soul. Rather than seeking wisdom from the Lord, the person leans into his own understanding. It's not so much that the Lord is silent as it is that the person is not listening to what he needs to hear. Now, I know you probably had this experience with someone. You're talking to them and they're sharing with you their troubles, and you just want to say, you're so wanting to say what they need to hear, but you know you can't say it. You just can't say it. Sometimes we do say it. Typically, when we do say it, it's wrong because we blurt it out. We say it in a sinful way. I mean, if you would just like stop doing that or whatever. That's one of the most painful things in conflict resolution, when you hear the person self-sabotaging themselves right in front of you, but you can't say anything. And then you go home and you tell your spouse, it's like, if she could just hear what she's saying. If she could just hear herself. I'm not throwing shade on women, that just came up. If he could just hear himself, he could just hear what he is saying. But they can't hear, and so you become silent, and that, in most cases, that's a wise response because they're not listening to what they need to hear. It's the silence of God that leads to the required answers. As our ways prove futile, we begin a process of coming to an end of ourselves in a prodigal kind of language. The end of yourself is the beginning of wisdom, and so you pray for that lady, that lady will, if she'll just get to the end of herself and stop that. Her motives, good desires, but they're twisted. If she would just get to the end of herself, she would receive wisdom. Once you are out of options and your plans are completely ruined, you turn to the Lord, then you're ready to listen, much like the prodigal son. We have to do it our way, and only when our ideas lead us to more desperation do we decide to be silent and listen to God. And you hear Job say this later on. I have spoken once, but no more. I put my hand over my mouth, as he will say eventually. I imagine that the prodigal came back with his hat in his hand, having much more respect, reverence for his father, leading to the wisdom that he lacked. And so it is with God. The fear of God and the silence of God work hand in hand. The Lord will use silence to lead us into a more profound desperation. After we exhaust our self-reliant resiliency and stop leaning on our understanding, we grow in our respect from God. After or as I was growing weary of grumbling and complaining, recognizing the spiritual exhaustion of such an exercise, it had a humbling effect, knowing that I could no longer manipulate the situation, and my fear of God began to grow proportionally. A new foundation begins to form. We're not as high-minded as we realize God has what we need. And our infatuation with ourselves and self-will impulse to do things our way has kept us from the inexhaustible supply of God's wisdom. Job needed to put his hat in his hand, which he did in the last chapter, as you begin to read in 42, verses 5 and 6, where he said, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you, wherefore I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes. And rather than accusing God for not meeting his desires in the way that he expected them, he should have humbled himself, recognizing that all of his motives, all of his preferences were not pure, and God would not take his anthropomorphic foot off his metaphorical neck until Job became fully honest about the operations of his heart. Like the prodigal, Job eventually came to his senses, as noted by putting his hand over his mouth. He stopped talking, and he began listening. That is when God broke through the silence and laid Job lower than he was when he came before God. The Lord wanted to ensure that Job's fear of God foundation was solid and secure, because God's desire for our old friend was to teach him wisdom, something that he could not do without a healthy fear of God. I'm not making an accusation here, as I've said a few times, against any of you, as much as a confession. It is hard to talk unashamedly about how we may be self-deceived, especially during our hard times. Sometimes we can want something so badly that we cannot see how our self-deception is bending our thinking in a wrong direction. This is something that you find hard when you're trying to help someone and you see the self-deception as they continue to talk, but you can't do anything about it. Literally and wisely, you know you can't and shouldn't do anything about it because they have not come to that respectful end of themselves. We're hurt, we're lonely, we're afraid, and God is silent. In nearly every case, his silence is because we will not let go of something that we want, something he knows is not best for us, thus the impasse. We disagree with God. Even when discussing those things with friends, we can become feisty and nasty and accusatory, especially if they do not see things our way. Ironically, our retorts and resistance to our friends reveal our most genuine thoughts about God. We neither fear our friends nor God. Our lack of fear of God sabotages any wisdom that he might desire to provide. Think about the parent with an angry child. What use is it to provide wisdom when the child is rebelling, accusatory, not at the end of himself, and continues to hold on to an agenda or a desire that is not best for him? There is no world where he will steward well whatever wisdom that you want to give him. It takes a lot of humble desperation to lay all of our cards on the table. If we're not willing to be honest, to be that honest, we will cut ourselves off from the wisdom of the Lord. This life intersection is where two or more critical questions we should be asking our friends are: one, are there any traces of my will, quote, my will be done, is there any traces of my will in your plans? I can think about so many prayers that I had back in that day, and it's not that those prayers are old and dust-covered. I have those same prayers today, that I want my will to be done and not God, and I will find traces of my will in my prayer. Question two, are you willing to have all your motives and agendas laid bare before the Lord? Asking these soul-searching questions is the beginning of wisdom. God will speak when we are willing to hold our ideas loosely while asking the Lord to use others to shake us from the things that have captured our hearts. The depth of self-deception and self-loyalty is more complicated and binding than we might want to believe. Imagine your child. Just suspend imagination for a second and think. Imagine if your child, if you're a parent, came to you and honestly asked, this is one of your children talking, what do you perceive about me that I may not recognize about myself? Will you help me to see what I cannot see? Now, I imagine that's a regular conversation in all of your homes. And I think that's great, and I rejoice with you, though I'm a bit jealous. What do you perceive about me that I may not recognize about myself? Will you help me to see what I cannot see? You would definitely speak because two things would be true. One, the child respects you and seeks your wisdom. And there's the fear of the Lord and wisdom tied together. He is not devising. He's not self-deceived. He wants what is best for him and recognizes that his self-loyalty blinds him from seeing what that is. And so he humbly asks you for wisdom out of a deep respect for you. Now, Imagine if a church member who is struggling and they came and asked that question, what do you perceive about me that I may not recognize about myself? Now that is a reciprocal question, by the way. It takes courage and humility to ask that question, and it takes courage and humility to answer that question. And I'm not so sure which is harder. I would say that it's harder to answer that question than to ask it. Because if you get to the place of asking it, if you're that broken, then it's not hard to ask that question. I mean, if you're broken, it's not hard to ask that question. When the prodigal came before his father, he had already planned in verse number 18 of Luke 15. He had already planned in verse number 18 what he was going to do. Going to his father and being humble, that was not hard. But I think sometimes on the other end of that we lack courage in answering that question honestly because we struggle with fear of man. And so that's a reciprocal question that requires courage and humility on both sides. He humbly asked for wisdom out of a respect for you. In Philippians 3, Paul said again, whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of this passing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. I finally admitted that I was holding on to something dear to me and I was afraid of losing it. But the Lord continued in silence, leading me into a more profound desperation. Eventually, I came to the place of owning my deception and I told the Lord that I needed him more than anything else in the world. He was realigning and readjusting my respect for him. We call this the fear of God. And though I thought I was taking my Christianity seriously, I was not taking it seriously enough. I wanted God plus other things. And Paul was correct. It's Christ plus nothing. Or our lives will sputter religiously while never finding satisfaction in the world's trinkets. God gave me a contrite recognition of who he is and what he can do and that he was for me. God was on my side. He was not against me at all. He wanted me to have wisdom, his wisdom, not my own. He wanted me to let go of any hint of selfishness regardless of the cost. He wanted me to trust him. Sometimes the silence of the Lord is the best thing for us. If you are experiencing the silence of the Lord, one of the best things you can do is find a place where you can scrutinize your motives and agendas. This step will be your first in stewarding his silence. Through the Lord's silence, we see an aspect of Job that was not clear to us when we first met him. Now, as we progress through the rest of the book, his hidden motives are being brought to light. After they are, then Job will experience transformation when God finally breaks through the silence and finally speaks in a few more chapters. Father, we love you. We are very grateful for your kindness. We are the people with hope. We have hope because we have been born again. And so, Lord, we do not see these problems and experience our sufferings the way that the world does. We are blessed upon all people, above all people of the world, as we have been regenerated. But, Lord, like the Father said in Mark 9, I believe, help my unbelief. Sometimes we can be unbelieving believers, fully saved, assured of heaven, but wavering in our faith as we move through this fallen world. So, Lord, I pray that you would help us to appropriately scrutinize, identify our motives, bringing them under the light of your word, the inspection of your spirit, and affirmed and understood, weighed within appropriate community, and that we can be clear in how we think about you and the desires of our hearts. Help us to grow in a proper fear of you. And then out of that fear, May we experience this active skill called wisdom, moving, doing, living in your world, always shored up by this healthy fear of you. Lord, help us to get to that place, each and every person in this room. And then for those that are struggling in a particular way, I pray that you would give them the courage, the humility, the grace to be able to ask the right questions to a close friend. And I pray that you would give that friend a courage to be able to speak the truth in love. And we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Thank